Thursday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast after a hiatus yesterday. We are back today with discussion of this absolute shocker in Game 6. Kawhi Leonard, as expected, did not play, and San Antonio throttled the Rockets by 39 points. We'll get into how that happened, why it happened, what happened to James Harden in this game. Then we're going to do some off-season previews, the fascinating LA Clippers, and the somewhat less fascinating, but still pretty interesting, actually, Memphis Grizzlies, who have a number of free agents themselves. Our sponsors today, Ball and Brand. B-O-L-L and Branch. Get $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free shipping in the U.S. when you use that CapSpace code. And CISO. Go to CISO.com right now and sign up for 2 weeks free using the promo code CapSpace at checkout for some awesome comedy. So before we get into this game itself, you had an interesting thought on Twitter of just where does this rank among the most shocking results in a playoff game compared to the pregame expectations? And you really have to look back at some of the more shocking games in recent NBA history.
You really do, because while these teams were pretty evenly matched, despite having very disparate outcomes in a lot of these games, Kawhi Leonard being out for the entirety and being ruled out, you know, before the game started. There was no drama with that. I think it happened like an hour or two before the game. So you're kind of sitting there going, okay, you know, I have a sense of where this is going. Houston's playing at home. They've done a pretty good job in this series. And they got the doors blown off. Like this wasn't even close. And that's what made it so startling to me, was not that they lost, though that was surprising. I mean, we talked before the game started about what we thought the odds were that San Antonio would win, but I don't think either of us would have put it above like a 1% chance that they just got smacked.
Yeah, you thought they would just slow it down and like maybe, you know, they could hold on and it'd be close at the end and Houston would be tired at the end or something like that. But this was not that at all. And I mean, to me, this is right up there. We put it out there. One of the suggestions was just game 7 of the 2016 finals as most shocking. I thought this was much more shocking because I felt all those games, I mean, the Cavs were coming off just having blown the Warriors out by 30 points the game before and had won the previous two games. I would go back to Houston Clippers game 6 in 2015, and I'm not talking about even during the game when the Clippers led by 19, but just beforehand, Chris Paul had missed two of the first games, and then they came back. The Clippers were on fire after having defeated San Antonio. They had destroyed Houston at home in games 3 and 4, so you felt like that they were sure to win that. Another one, San Antonio Miami in game 4 in 2014, when San Antonio had won comfortably in game 3, and you felt like, all right, Miami has got to win this now in game 4 at home. And then they just completely didn't respond, got blown out again. And probably the biggest one that I would point to would be Cleveland and Boston in game 5, 2010, where LeBron James shot like 3 out of 14. And Cleveland lost 120-88 to what is like a pretty miserable Boston offense. And that Cleveland team, you know, everyone thought they were going to the finals, they were going to win the championship. They were the number one seed in the East. They'd won 60 games. That Boston team had struggled to, they were 500 over their last 54 games of the season. And then they just worked them. I mean, I can't remember the feeling of that. And that's the famous LeBron leaving the court, like taking his jersey off. And everyone's like, is that the last time he's ever going to do it in Quick Loans Arena? And it was for quite a time. And then the other one that I looked at too, Golden State and Dallas, but there really wasn't a single game in that series that was just like so particularly shocking, because by the end, the game one, it's like, all right, you know, you can get a shocker sometimes in game one when Golden State won that. And then by the time you got to game 6, which ended up being a blowout as well, Golden State had been outplaying them throughout the series. So there wasn't one individual game that was like some huge shocker in that series, but this, and just like, not only the fact that they lost, but just getting rolled like this, just having no energy. James Harden just looked like he was like, I mean, Stephen A. Smith said on the ESPN broadcast after the game that he looked like he'd been drugged, and like he did. It really was an apt metaphor.
You know that one of my favorite descriptions to make for turnovers in particular is whether it is a forced or an unforced error, kind of going back to tennis. And James Harden's turnover turnovers in the early part of this game, of which there were many. You know, he had 5 in the first half. He had 5 points in the first half. Most of them were at least were lightly forced at most. And that's not trying to kill the Spurs. Like, oh, they're doing that. They were just taking advantage of Harden playing horrendous, horrendous, horrendous basketball.
I mean, he had 2 turnovers in the first quarter. One where he just threw a hit-ahead pass to Ariza. That hit-ahead is probably way too kind for the speed that it had. He just lofted it 50 feet in the air, got intercepted. He had one play where DeJounte Murray just like picked him off in the backcourt. Then in the second quarter, one of the turnovers that we featured on Dunked On Video today, where he just threw it right to Patty Mills after he tried to draw a foul. It was just, it seemed like mentally he just wasn't there, and physically he had no juice, and the numbers that you looked into really bore that out.
So thanks to SportView cameras, we can get a much better sense of how a player moves and how quickly. And Harden ran 2.05 miles in this game, which was about the same as Patty Mills. So you might go, oh, okay, you know, look at that, about the same as Patty Mills. Patty Mills played 7 fewer minutes in this game than Harden did. And his average miles per hour was slower than every player on the floor other than Bobby Brown, who only played in garbage time, and was similar. His speed was slower, but similar to Marc Gasol's in the playoffs, and slower than every NBA player, including DeMarcus Cousins, during the regular season.
It was really incredible. And granted, he was guarding in the post a fair amount of that time, so he didn't need to move as much. And he always is kind of slow, and that's not the death knell. If you're holding the ball, handling at the top, running pick and rolls, you're not running off of screens in the half court. But usually he's ridiculous in transition. I don't think he came even close to having one transition basket in this game. And, you know, there was one play that was notable early on where he gets the defensive rebound, or I can't remember if it was a rebound or an outlet, and Pau Gasol and David Lee are both behind him. And both of those guys, and so he's got the advantage situation, and both of those guys beat him down the floor and are like back on defense in like easy order. It was just such an odd performance. He didn't take his first shot attempt until I think 6 minutes remained in the first half. He had more field goals or more turnovers than field goals in this game. He only had 2 field goals and 6 turnovers, 7 assists, which is not that much. Ended up fouling out as well. He had 3 fouls in the first half, and D'Antoni took him out and looked like he almost was happy to be able to, frankly, because it was such a struggle. And the other thing that was amazing, it's not like Houston, at least, you know, in the fourth quarter when it was total garbage time, they couldn't score at all. But through the first 3 quarters, they actually shot like 37% on 3-pointers. They were 13 out of 33. That's not bad. It's a lot of threes to get up. But the 2-point shooting that they had, caused, again, by the Spurs going big, Pau Gasol, LaMarcus Aldridge were just huge, stopping the Houston Rockets at the rim.
Yeah, I mean, Houston was not getting to they were not taking shots in the restricted area nearly as much as they want to. The Spurs were doubling them up, I think, either at the end of the first quarter or midway through the second. The first time I looked at it, the Spurs had like 20 attempts in the restricted area. And overall, Houston only scored 78.4 points per 100 possessions when James Harden was on the floor in this game.
Yeah, and again, that's skewed a little bit by the fourth quarter when I think they were just like so demoralized. But I'll give you some stats.
Do you want me to give you for the first 3 quarters? I can dig it out.
Yeah, now let's see it. I mean, I've got a few for you. Yeah, Houston was 11 of 29. They shot 38% on threes, so that wasn't the problem. The problem was on twos, they were 6 out of 16 in the restricted area, a further 1 out of 5 from floater range. That's just completely miserable with all, so 7 out of 21 in the paint. And they only took one mid-ranger, true mid-range shot outside the paint in the first 3 quarters. And then also the turnovers were bad, but those didn't kill them either. They only had 11. That's not like such a ridiculous amount. They got to the foul line a reasonable amount, 17 out of 24. It's just they couldn't score at the rim. It was insane. And meanwhile, San Antonio, despite going 4 out of 17 on their own three-pointers, they worked them on the offensive glass, which continued going early into the fourth quarter. San Antonio led by 23 after the third, but you know, obviously they outscored them by a further almost 20 points in the fourth. And so that meant that San Antonio shot 17 out of 26 at the rim. I remember, again, this is through 3 quarters. And then a further 8 out of 14 in the paint. But where they really completely destroyed them was in mid-range, 11 out of 16, 70% almost from mid-range. And that was LaMarcus Aldridge just completely eviscerating this Houston team. It appears that the complaints about him being overpaid were a bit premature.
In the first three quarters, Aldridge had 28 points on 13 of 23 shooting, and he only got to the line twice. He had two of two from the line, was comfortable basically on every guy the Rockets put on him, and was helpful defensively. I mean, that wasn't certainly the forte of his game, but he was the closest he has been to undeniable since his time in Portland to me.
Yeah, I mean, he did have a couple of 40-point games in the first two games against OKC last year, but I mean, that was more kind of pick and pops. This was him just going to work mostly in the post and absolutely eviscerating Ryan Anderson. They would get the switch on Harden. Clint Capella even was a little bit better, but still largely powerless. And I thought it really just Aldridge knowing that he just had to be the guy and produce, and they were just going to give it to him and give it to him and give it to him and as much as he could take. Because it seemed like their strategy initially was, hey, we're just going to go into the post every time, and we're going to grind it out and try to slow them down, because obviously they're going to miss Kawhi on defense too, you thought. So they're going to try and slow Houston down, like control tempo by going into the post. And so I think just the fact that he knew he was going to keep getting the ball was huge, and he was just so much more decisive with his moves. He was getting separation, and most of all, the ball was just going in on some of these contested jumpers. But I did think that he was getting better looks in this game, either by turning and facing and shooting over the top, which is something Jeff Van Gundy suggested that he could do on the low post, driving and getting to his right hand. He also had four offensive boards. He just was unbelievable in this one.
A couple of other ridiculous things from the first three quarters of this game. You talked about how San Antonio, their offense was fueled by two-pointers. Another crazy part of that is that they only attempted 5 free throws in the first three quarters and yet still led by 23. They had a 5-24 free throw attempt disparity in the first three quarters. But also, you talked about that they had a lot of offensive rebounds. They had 9. They only had 8 second chance points, but they had 50 points in the paint. They almost outscored the Rockets in the paint alone in those first three quarters.
We would not be complete without discussing the 19-3 run that we featured in Dunked On Video, which was accomplished mostly with the Spurs reserves in the game. DeJounte Murray had an excellent game, even though he only had 4 points in the first three quarters. Overall, though, he was important in them maintaining the lead early into the fourth. I thought he was excellent defensively. Murray finished 5 out of 10 with 11 points. Also had 10 rebounds. He was big on the glass. And then 5 assists for Murray. Kyle Anderson chipped in with a big three-pointer, a couple of soft mid-rangers, kept the ball moving as well. He was +9 in only 11 minutes. He was out there when they were doing well. 3 assists for Anderson. David Lee was +17 in his 8 minutes in the first half. And Jonathan Simmons was really the second best player. I might actually say that Pau Gasol was their second best player in this game because of what the problems that he caused around the rim for the Spurs. But John Simmons was right up there too, and he was 7-11 from the field. He had 15 points and was +19 through the first three quarters.
He looked so much more comfortable as an offensive player than I've really ever seen from him in the last couple of games of the series. Driving, couple of nice drives, couple really nice finishes that we've seen before. But was very impressed with him overall. He will be a big part of the Western Conference Finals, even if he's presumably not going to start. And yes, I mean, San Antonio's role players really came out in this one. I thought Manu, even though his shooting numbers weren't great, I thought he played some nice help defense, was kind of there when they needed somebody. Yeah. And Kyle Anderson, we've criticized him many times for good reason, but he moved the ball well at a couple of key moments in this game. And so did Lee. They each had some nice passes.
Yeah. And with Houston basically moving in molasses, it was a lot easier for Sloma to keep up. And overall, 28 assists through the first three quarters for San Antonio, a team that has not really been that high in the assist rankings of late. And they really, it was Aldridge in the post, obviously, who was killing. But then whenever he didn't score himself, it was either him or Gasol getting double team and swinging it around, or just, I mean, that second unit that started the second quarter with Lee at center, Anderson at power forward, they were playing like beautiful old school Spurs basketball, not old school, but old school, like 2014 style Spurs basketball, just driving and kicking relentlessly. They had a bunch of guys who could put the ball on the floor. Murray, Simmons, Patty Mills was out there during that time. Lee had some nice finishes in the pick and roll. He had some nice passes, and it was really like incredible to watch what they were doing. And then they didn't turn it over at all either. And so that led to them taking 22 more shot attempts. Granted, part of that was due to free throws than the Rockets did through the first three quarters.
It might be impossible to overstate how ridiculous the disparity was, especially compared to expectations. But also, you know, the Rockets were missing some shots you'd expect them to make, but it wasn't like they were doing that all the time. This wasn't like a true worst case scenario, everything goes wrong in the traditional sense of like, you know, it's a make or miss league. They just sucked.
I mean, a lot of this too was just, all right, they got to the rim, they missed a lot of layups. Some of them were contested, but some of them were just like bonked.
Yeah, that's true.
And San Antonio going 11 out of 16 for mid-range, I mean, that's not something that happens. And so part of it, I think, you know, Houston wasn't as bad, especially during that run. You know, they missed like four wide open threes in a row during that run.
That's a fair point.
So if they make a couple of those, maybe it's not as bad. But Harden, certainly, I mean, there's no denying the way that he looked and played and the lack of juice that he had. Patrick Beverley, we didn't see the impact from him. He only took three shot attempts and didn't have a steal. He wasn't pressuring up the way you expected him to. It just seemed like they weren't getting any loose balls, any hustle plays. The closeouts just weren't happening for them. They just looked like an exhausted team. And I mean, you just struggle though to find an explanation for Harden in particular to not even have energy on offense. It was just pretty remarkable. And maybe, you know, someone noted that after he got clocked in the face in game five, he really kind of wasn't the same in that game. And then he wasn't. So maybe he was like feeling some kind of effects from that. I mean, that's total speculation. Or maybe he was just exhausted and maybe he should have actually not been fighting so hard for the regular season MVP and gotten some rest so that he would have the type of vigor that the Spurs had in this series.
A couple of hustle stats, since I already had the tab up and you mentioned it. The Rockets only had two screen assists in this entire game, both of which were Ryan Anderson, who didn't score. And the Spurs, this is a stat that Chris Herring, our friend who works for 538, had. San Antonio contested 34 of Houston's 43-point shots, which is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, that's from the hustle stats, not the sport view stats. So I'm not sure like how those percentages differ, but that's still pretty impressive. And you know, again, Houston, it's not like they missed a ton of shots from 3-point range in the first three quarters. Like that wasn't the problem, not hitting enough threes. A few other little notes here. John Simmons scored in double figures in five of the six games in this series, and he had scored more than 10 in just one of his nine career playoff games before this. Houston scored 75 points. It was their second lowest in any game during the James Harden era for Ben Golliver and lowest in the playoffs. And it was just a crazy game. I was shocked by it. We were shocked by it. I mean, it just seemed like all of a sudden you looked up and you're like, this is an 18-point game. Like, what is going on here? And you always felt like Houston would make a run and they never even did that. I think the lowest they got it under was like 19 points maybe in the second half. Like you felt like, okay, maybe they could make a run. They went down 30, then they got it to 22 with eight straight points. And you're like, oh, maybe this will be the start of it early in the third. And then nothing happened again. Just an absolutely remarkable end. And you can't say enough about the Spurs and their culture. And if this had happened in the regular season, I mean, probably even a blowout, we'd be surprised. But you felt like, all right, you know, teams, this happens in the regular season because teams just like take the Spurs lightly. And you know, if Kawhi sits out or whatever, it doesn't matter. Like that's what they just have their system. Teams aren't prepared for them. Whatever. But they still had some great players and some prop players. And Houston, other than for the second half of game four and the first half of game five, maybe even the first quarter of game five, they never really figured out how to deal with San Antonio's strategy of just leaving the bigs back by the rim. And they just shot extremely poorly over them at the rim. And, you know, Bob Vulgaris has made this point that if you're just never going to shoot mid-rangers and you don't have guys who are even used to taking those shots, that maybe maybe that just means that if you decide as a team, all right, we'll just give them that entire area of the court, maybe you can actually be successful if you are as smart and disciplined and you have the defenders that San Antonio does. But I don't even know how much of it was that. It's just like, you know, San Antonio's defenders wore down Houston over the course of the series. And then San Antonio's size, like once Nene went out, they just couldn't deal with it. They tried playing Anderson together with Capella. That didn't really work at all either. Those two guys started the second half together. The Anderson at center lineups, which we had been calling for, ended up getting worked pretty badly. They never made Pau Gasol defend in space really at all. And Pop did a great job of slotting him into matchups where he could be successful guarding Capella. They put LaMarcus Aldridge on Trevor Ariza, and LaMarcus Aldridge was unbelievable guarding Trevor Ariza, and then also being effective still at the rim defensively. Is just really a triumph for the San Antonio Spurs, and one that I didn't think they could do it, but I picked Houston in six, obviously. Then after game two, I actually changed my pick. This might be unfair to shovel dirt on this guy's season, but do you think that Tony Parker going out actually like ended up being a boon for the Spurs ultimately?
I think more yes than no, though there's plenty of on both sides. Patty Mills is a much better defender, and I think that really helped San Antonio out in some key moments. I think that difference mattered more in game five than any other game in this series, but game five was on a razor's edge, so that's certainly fair. And DeJounte Murray...
Well, here, actually, let me break in here, because you mentioned Mills starting the game. I think that especially in this game, when they needed more spacing around those post-ups, when you don't have to guard Parker, I mean, Patty Mills is a wetter. Like, you have to guard him at the three-point line. He's one of the best three-point shooting ones in the league if he's open. The fact that he was out there with these post guys helped make that strategy going against, you know, James Harden guarding Pau Gasol in the post helped make them that much more effective.
Right, and this is another example of a truly deficient shooting guard really causing problems, because as many talented players as most high-end teams have, you don't have many hiding places. So like that was an issue for DeRozan in the Raptors series and various other series that Toronto's played in the recent past. And it was an issue for Harden here. I wanted to, before, I don't know if we're getting ready to move on, but two kind of ridiculous stats that also came out of this game and more out of this playoff so far. Home teams are now 0-9 when facing elimination in the playoffs so far. And then a little piece of trivia, I think this actually came from Jalen Rose, is 10 of the 11 series so far have ended with the road team closing out the series. Can you think of the one exception?
The Houston Rockets.
Yep.
Game five, Oklahoma City. Yeah, and that's why you're beating me, by the way, because I'm always like, well, I don't want to pick a team to close it out on the road.
It is,
and you've been all about picking that, and you have been more than correct on most of these picks, especially in the first round. Last stat here, the Rockets were 9 out of 37 on two-pointers. 24% on two-pointers. That's just incredible, and especially considering how few mid-range jumpers they take to shoot that badly on two-pointers. A lot of that, again, was compiled in garbage time, but nonetheless, just pretty remarkable stuff from those San Antonio bigs, and from their smalls who just do a great job of fighting over screens and contesting and just not letting them get anything easy. Let's get to now the LA Clippers offseason preview, but first, this from our new sponsor, Ball and Branch, B-O-L-L and Branch. .com is the website to get the best sheets that you have ever slept on. Buying sheets is another one of these things where the marketing doesn't really make any sense. It's impossible to go into the store and just like put your hand on the sheet and know what it's going to feel like to sleep on, or know how it's going to be after it gets washed. They advertise thread count, but that really doesn't mean anything at all. And in fact, it's a myth that the higher the thread count, the better the sheet. Instead, Bull and Branch focuses on the quality of the thread, such as the weight of the fabric, the type of the weave, the quality of the cotton, rather than just inflating their thread count number to not mean anything. But, you know, all this, these claims, I happen to really like the sheets, but you have to take my word for it or theirs, because they have a 30-day, I guess 30 nights would be more accurate, guarantee. If you're not impressed by them, return them for a full refund. And of course, you would get a nice discount, $50 off of your first set of sheets, plus free shipping in the US when you use the promo code CAPSPACE, which of course lets them know that you came from us as well. So ballandbranch.com, B-O-L-L and branch.com. Use that CAPSPACE code to get $50 off what we think will be the best sheets that you've ever slept on. So the Clippers, I think a lot of the same themes with them that we addressed earlier this week, talking about Toronto, just like what is important when you own a team? What is the goal basically of owning a team? And how does that fit into the context of when you've had a solid team for a long time and you need to re-sign stars who are going to be bad contracts by the end of their new deals, and you're probably not going to be in contention for a championship this year anyway, but yet the alternative is just being bad, and you know, why do you want to do that? So do you re-sign these guys or not? But I think there are still some significant differences between this Clippers team and Toronto, even if the Clippers, of course, reside in the more difficult conference.
There are a couple of very important ones. I think the biggest one to me is that even at their ceiling, it's hard to see a path for the Clippers to make money. Much noise in the Western Conference. You know, Toronto, we never really saw it all the way. You know, all these pieces together, you can concoct a scenario where, yeah, their offense is probably going to underperform relative to their regular season success, but their defense is intriguing and everything like that. We've seen the Clippers. They can be very good, but they're also getting older. They're going to be worse each year. And it's harder for them to keep it together than it is for Toronto because half of Toronto's key players are already under contract.
Well, so do you think, because to me, I actually think it's more compelling for the Clippers to just pay what it takes and keep this team together than Toronto. Do you feel that way as well?
What do you mean by compelling?
That just like if I were the owner, I'd be more motivated to keep this team together in LA than with Toronto's personnel.
I disagree with one exception, which is the if they're going to try to get their own stadium, then it gets complicated because then you want to have a good team out there to try to get the money or however they're going to do that, unless Bomber's
just
going to pay it out of his own pocket.
Or even just a renegotiation. Then it doesn't matter. Yeah, I mean, or even just better terms of their Staples Center lease, which by all accounts is pretty crappy. And but also remember too, they have this, they signed kind of an ad hoc like 2-year extension, I think, with Fox Sports to do their games. And the price for that was, you know, I don't remember exactly, but somewhere in like the $50 million per season range. And the consultants that Ballmer hired to look at the team when he was buying it thought that they could get $100 million per season. And so that's now that they're not getting as much as they thought they would, maybe they're not as profitable. Supposedly Ballmer, like they all say, says, well, you know, if a team is a contender, I'll keep them together. We'll see whether he believes this team is a contender still. I don't. But then, you know, they also have this issue of if their TV deal is up for renegotiation in 2 years and they're just absolutely horrendous at that point, like now they're going to lose a lot of money there as well. But I think Ballmer, less than most owners, he's more viewing this as like kind of a toy and he wants to win and he gets really into the game and he sits really close and all that. And it's just kind of, I don't think he's as worried about the profits necessarily. But you know, maybe that's just me trying to read the tea leaves. I could be wrong there.
That's fair. But if you take the Ballmer part out of it, if it were like, let's say I own the team with my own ethos and everything, why I would rather take the Clippers apart than the Raptors is that it's easier and they're in a market where doing that can actually create some incentives. So partially because of how massively the Lakers messed up last summer, there's a very good chance that the Clippers next summer could be the most put together, in whatever sense you want to say, of the major market teams. It's because Brooklyn, you know, they're still in their whole thing. The Knicks, we'll see where they are at that point. The Lakers have all this money and Mozgov and Deng. If they cleaned house, they'd be in a pretty good spot. I mean, it's a nice city.
Well,
they
so
don't
what is
have...
cleaning house? You're not re-signing. Who are you not re-signing? Because they've got Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, JJ Redick, and then a bunch of role guys as well. But those are the three. Are you going to let all three of those guys go?
I would consider it. So, to me, if Redick's leaving, like if it, Redick is kind of, in as strange as it sounds, he might be the linchpin. Because I am not personally comfortable, if it were me, signing Paul or Blake Griffin with the intent to trade them within a year and a half. I think that's a little bit of dirty pool, and I think that's the type of thing that could lead to a player not doing it, unless the player is okay with that. And there could be circumstances where that's possible, like Blake Griffin, because Griffin can get more money with the Clippers. He can get that extra year. If the player's cool with it, then I'm totally down if they want to do that. But then the other big part of this
is, remember, if you're trying to rebuild and you're going to trade away a Chris Paul or a Blake Griffin, like they can't really get much in the way of assets. But I mean,
I was going to go. Like, do those guys a year from now, do those guys pass the Nene test? And I think they probably do, but it's hard to know for sure. Yeah. Health is going to be a huge factor in that. But so
I think Paul is more likely to than Griffin, actually, to be honest.
So would I. Yeah. And that's, yeah, I'm trying not to repeat myself because I wrote the SI preview today for it. And without, I had totally forgotten we were doing the Clippers today. I was just writing it anyway. And I wrote about that I think Chris Paul is actually less scary to a team to sign than Blake is right now, just because of the way they're
feel free to repeat yourself. I mean, I know that I get this too, where like if I said something before somewhere else, like I just feel this cognitive dissonance that I'm repeating myself. But, you know, this is a podcast and that's an article.
Yeah, but so. There's and so that ties in with the second big part of this, which is DeAndre Jordan. So DeAndre Jordan, after all the drama that happened in 2015, you think, oh, he signed a contract, he's going to be a Clipper for a while. He's a free agent next summer. What that means as a practical matter is that he can blow this whole thing up if he wants to do anything else. And he's gotten very close to blowing that whole thing up before. This is not a circumstance where you're sitting there going, oh, he's a brand loyalist, he's not going to do that. I mean, he was basically a house away from doing that before. So if they re-signed everybody and then DeAndre left, either A, he has you over a barrel and you have to give him the full max. Like that's a possibility. And then that contract's probably not going to age well.
And he would be 10 years of experience at that point,
so
too.
He'd be getting Supermax with a higher cap than Chris Paul's getting. And
that would be $35 million a year to start. Just to put in context, by the way, these contracts we're talking about, some quick housekeeping. Paul, like Kyle Lowry, five-year deal, the most he could get, $205 million. Blake Griffin, his max, assuming he does not make an All-NBA team this year, which is virtually impossible, would be starting at $30.3 million, 5 years, $175.7 million for Griffin if he were to re-sign with the Clippers. And then if either of them were to sign elsewhere, knock a year and about $45 million off of almost $50 million in the case of Paul off of that contract. So four for 130 for Blake, four for 152 for Paul with his greater experience level.
So yeah, the DeAndre part of this is very important to me, because if you're seeing them as an investment and everything else like that, especially if they're disappointing next year, DeAndre could basically just say, like, other than liking being in LA, that it's just not what he wants. And so if he goes, then you're just a husk of a team, and maybe those guys pass the NNA test, maybe they don't. You're getting into a perilous spot. And then the other crazy part of this Clippers team is how few guys they have under contract right now. So how much they're going to have to restock, even if they re-sign all those guys. The Clippers only have 6 players under contract for next year, and only 3 of those players were a part of their playoff rotation. DeAndre, who's going to be expiring after next year, Jamal Crawford, who has a partial guarantee after next year, and Austin Rivers, who has a player option after next year. So you could see this entire team turn over in 2 years.
I think I would engage in one of two plans if I were Ballmer. And I don't think that, I think they're probably just going to try to re-sign both those guys. And then Redick, I think they're probably going to let go, especially based on the reporting that's appeared in multiple places now that he wants $18 to $20 million a year. We don't know how many years that is. You know, if it's 4, that's probably no good. If it's 3 or 2, then yeah, I think that's probably reasonable. But Broderick Turner reporting today that's what Redick wants. And, you know, many envision him, you know, citing a number of league sources, some of whom might even have been with the Clippers, envision him not returning. And obviously he leaves with a sour taste after getting completely shut down in that Jazz series. And he's age 33. By the way, Paul is 32 and Blake Griffin, a very, very well-worn 28. And also Turner reporting today that Griffin may not even be ready until the start of the exhibition season to like really be back at like full bore cleared for activities. So that's another concern. I mean, I think he'll probably still get max offers anyway, but you know, just in terms of like, okay, can he come back? Like, will we ever see old Blake? Like, this is another lost summer for him now. He had one last year too with that quadriceps tendon issue. But so there's a long way of background here. I would do one of two things. Re-sign Griffin and Paul. See how you're doing. Also, both those guys will be eligible for no trade clauses, which will be very interesting if they can negotiate those. That would be, if they want those, I'm probably, that's going to make me think twice, especially for Griffin. But, you know, they both will be 8-4 guys, and you can only get a no trade clause if you sign a new contract rather than an extension. And Paul wasn't eligible last time because he hadn't spent 4 years on the Clippers, but now, of course, he is, and Griffin has been there for his whole career. So that's another thing to think about. But assuming you can get no trade clause, I would say, all right, we're going to run it back. one more time here. And then next, if it doesn't work out this year, because, you know, again, we still haven't been healthy, these guys haven't had a chance, blah, blah, blah. Then DeAndre, either at the trade deadline, when you're right, it's just clearly not working now. You know, we're going to win 46 games this year. We're just not that good. You could move DeAndre still, maybe even try to move Paul and Griffin at that point and just totally hit the reset. You know, that's what one option, because if they bring back DeAndre, you know, they're going to be like crazy into the tax next year. They'll be crazy in the tax this year. We'll talk more about that if they just bring everyone back. Option two, which I hadn't really thought about until you mentioned it, was you were saying maybe just hit the reset button. I'm saying you let Griffin go, re-sign Chris Paul, and then just say, hey, Chris, you know, we just got to chill for this season, and then next year we can have $45 million in cap space, which is not really that much because Paul's gonna be making $38 million. You got roster charges, and Wes Johnson will still be around making $6.1 million. He's not declining that player option, but maybe that can be the plan. It's just like, all right, you know, maybe we can just build a whole new team around Chris Paul. If we let DeAndre Jordan go, you know, he's gonna be super overpaid on his next contract. He's relying on athleticism. We want no part of that. Maybe we can just get, as you said, there aren't gonna be a ton of teams that are looking great for 2018 free agency other than the Spurs that are good, and is hopefully Chris Paul stays good next year and people will want to just come to LA to play to Chris Paul with Chris Paul, and they can continue to put together a decent team that has like some more flexibility going forward. What do you think of that idea?
I think you're putting a lot of eggs in the Chris Paul basket, and I love Chris Paul. I've been a huge fan of his for a long time, but that's a lot for a small 33-year-old point guard. And the Clippers, well,
I think people keep saying always small, but like, you know, I think he's really proven that he's not that reliant on like his height or anything. Like the idea that he's small, I think if that were going to be the issue, I think it already would have been the issue. You know,
there's just a history of short point guards not being long, and you can make an argument that because he's strong, yeah, because he,
but
plays
he hasn't been beating people with quickness for the last 3 years already, right? Reason that's the case, yeah. So I my personal opinion is I think he already has aged better than a lot of those guys. You know, even like Tony Parker, I think he's going to age way better than Tony Parker, and his shooting is still going to be, you know, really good, and he's still strong, so he can switch, and I mean, like the fact that he plays the level of defense that he plays at this age and size is ridiculous. But anyway, I digress.
Take all that at face value, and I love Chris Paul. Even so, do you think that a late 20s like Paul George type, for example, would rather hitch his wagon to an already locked in and no trade clause Chris Paul, or any other player that they could get that might be interested either that year or the next year? Because the Clippers, if they cleared their books that dominantly, they wouldn't have any, like, it wouldn't be like they would have any guys cropping up in terms of expenses. It would be years before anybody got really expensive. I think that you would rather have the openness of LA and everything else in another city. Like, if that your Chris Paul plan, I think in other places would be even more tantalizing, but in LA, I think that I would rather choose the open books, and as long as you had somebody that you trusted to actually make good draft picks, which is not Doc Rivers.
No, it's Rock Divers.
Excellent point. But that, and that ties in with, so I made the comment about how, you know, they only have six guys under contract and only three of them played in the postseason or were in the postseason rotation, because technically Wes Johnson played. Wes Johnson seems like a misfire by Doc, either Rock the GM or Doc the coach. We don't really know which one, but
just
one of the
no two. Communication in that between the front office and the coaching staff whatsoever.
The hemispheres are just off. The other two are Bryce Johnson.
The Chinese wall in Rock Divers' mind is strong, I guess.
It is, apparently. And so Bryce Johnson, never want to write off a guy who's a rookie, but he doesn't look like anything special when I've seen him play. And then Diamond Stone, intriguing talent. You know, maybe he ends up being a rotation guy. He's a second round pick. Big whoop. That's it. Like, the cupboard is basically bare, but their future obligations are really weird, because the only pick they owe after this year, they don't have any draft picks this season, is a lottery protected first that reverts into a second round pick. So if they take a little bit of time to get moving, they're fine.
Yeah, that's at least the one thing compared to like some of these others where they at least have protected those picks lottery wise. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty, let's say they bring all these guys back, just to give you an idea of what the tax bill would be. If they re-sign Chris Paul and Blake, you're $26 million over the cap, $6 million over the tax. So you're you're going to be limited to, even if Ballmer is willing to spend the mini mid-level, which would be basically the most you can offer is a 3-year, $16 million contract with that. And then you're then limited to a bunch of minimums. And their needs at that point would be a starting two, a starting three, a backup four, a backup five, a backup one, and because Rock doesn't trust Wes Johnson, a backup three. Unless you want to say that Austin Rivers is now your starting two. And actually, both Rivers actually has a player option at the end of next year. Crawford, I think, has $3 million guaranteed in for the 18-19 season, so that's money that they might be able to get off next year, you know, as I'm talking about them potentially rebuilding the team. That's just too many things, though, that they need. I mean, they had no depth when they had JJ Redick making $7 million a year, and now you're going to lose him, and they have no way to replace him other than the mini mid-level. Doc Rivers has done admirably with the limited resources at his disposal, but this is going to press even that. I mean, you can't just keep filling out these incredibly huge needs with minimum contracts and like one small exception contract every year, because they have absolutely no rookies who are going to do anything. Bryce Johnson, I mean, I'm sure as hell not counting on him to do anything next year. There's no reason to do that. Stone, actually, I might give him a shot at some backup 5 minutes, but I don't know if this organization will do that. And other than that, you know, they have no other young prospects. They haven't been able to find like cheap guys who are young that they could develop. All those guys that they bring in are old. So I don't know. It's pretty difficult. We should talk a little bit more about some of their other free agents, though, Danny, who, you know, other than those big three of Redick and Griffin and Paul. And by the way, if they bring back Redick as well, they are $21 million over the tax, and that's with only 9 guys on the roster. So you're already looking at and that's assuming Redick would play for $15 million. He's probably going to want more than that, but maybe they say, hey, we'll give you more years and if you'll do $15 million. So then they are $20 million over the tax, more than that, and total team salary is $206 million, and that's before you even use any like mini mid-level or, you know, just fill out your roster. They only got 9 guys in that situation, so it's hard to imagine that Ballmer would greenlight that kind of a tax bill for a team that just is not realistically a championship contender. So you have to imagine that either Redick's out the door or they find a way to move Crawford or Rivers Redick does return, but again, it seems pretty unlikely that he will.
You want to talk about their other free agents? We certainly should. Luke Richard and Bob Mute has a player option worth $2.3 million. He will decline that, and he can either re-sign with the Clippers as an early bird guy. That's a possibility, but again, they're not going to have much money. And then he could also just sign somewhere else. He can sign wherever he wants. Most Bates, $2.1 million player option. Expect that he will decline that as well. Then their other...
$2.1 million? No, I don't think it's that much.
Well, because
that's
the new minimum.
The minimum?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, you're right. Yeah, okay.
And so yeah, because his goes up. And then the other ones are Ray Felton, straight unrestricted, Brandon Bass, unrestricted, Alan Anderson, forgotten and unrestricted.
And as you mentioned, no picks this year. So let's say they don't bring Redick back. They bring back Paul and Griffin. That seems like the most likely scenario to me, if those guys want to stay, and they're going to pay them. I mean, they basically anybody who can play at all, but I'm just trying to think of guys who might be available for some of the resources that they have. At point guard, you know, maybe they could bring back Felton by, you know, dipping into their mini mid-level. I think Felton can get more than just the straight up minimum this year. It's good. The backup point guard market is not that good. A lot of teams need backup point guards. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of Brandon Jennings, Jose Calderon, like that kind of level of guy. Try to make Austin Rivers or Crawford a point guard, both of whom have desperately failed in that role. Anyone else you think at point guard that might be realistic for them, you know, given the resources they have? And of course, I mean, they're going to need to start playing Paul less minutes too. That's another issue.
Did Jarrett Jack ever have a good game against Doc in the playoffs?
No, by the time the Warriors and Clippers played, Jack was already on the Cleveland Cavaliers.
So yeah, I think the point guard market is thin, but I think that the most compelling use of their money in that circumstance would be if, and this is a massive if, any of the swingman shooters just get a more tepid market than they expect to give them a 1-year make good. I don't think, I seem like I'm throwing them out for almost every spot, but CJ Miles would be interesting, just if like, let's say the market is just a little bit flatter for him. If he could start, you know, start for the Clippers, probably put up a ton of points just because there will be opportunities. He'll get fed by Chris Paul. That option is there. But the problem is a lot of those shooting guys are a little bit older. You know, they're Nick Young is 32. CJ Miles is 30. Kyle Korver is 36. Are they really going to take the risk of a one-year deal with the Clippers for the mid-level exception? It's hard to say.
No, and maybe it would be more than 1 year too, but I mean, I think there are a lot of bigs. I'm less concerned about their bigs. I think they could just get like four of these guys who are kind of reclamation projects and hopefully, you know, two of them work out. On the wing, the pickings are a lot slimmer. I think maybe like Brandon Rush might be someone that they could look at. Jody Meeks, Gerald Green, Anthony Morrow, maybe Tabo Sefolosha if the market is worse for Sefolosha than we think it might be. Matt Barnes could always come back. He's 38 next year. But I think that's like the type of market that we're talking about here. And we don't even know if Ballmer is going to green light using the entire mini mid-level and then how long of a contract they can get. Give out with that even either.
It's a good point because you have those extended costs. If they re-sign Paul and Griffin, you have to look at the future then because those guys are just going to stay on the books.
So I predicted that Griffin and Paul will return. What do you believe?
I think the same. I think that the Clippers are going to offer both of them lucrative five-year deals, probably their max, and both of them will stay. Whether they finish those contracts in LA is a different question, but I think they will both be Clippers to start next year.
Do you think one or both of them get a no trade clause?
Oof.
I mean, after this Melo saga, Paul, I could give a no trade clause to because I think just the idea of him just being, you know, the greatest Clipper ever. And Blake Griffin is like kind of a franchise icon as well. And maybe just the fact that these guys, you know, were both on this team for 10 years for a team that has no history. And Blake Griffin, at least like once was a star, maybe you can continue to sell him long after he actually, you know, is going to be a championship level of player. But man, I mean,
got it. How depressing is it to think of him as their Kobe? But that's not that far off.
Their Kobe, except like 5 years younger, but he's at like reaching the level of effectiveness. Well, no, but
the idea of him being like one of the best guys in franchise history, and so you just kind of keep him around to sell tickets and that sort of thing. I don't think he's there yet, but the idea is that you have to be thinking about that fourth and fifth year kind of in that vein, just because that's being practical. Yeah. He could outperform that, but that's the way we have to think about it.
Will Rock Divers and Doc Rivers be in LA next year?
Yes, according to this plan. I mean, he first of all, he'd be leaving a lot of money on the table. And the other huge part of this is timing. Like, if he knew today that they were going to not re-sign Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, maybe he'd be trying to figure out a way to get into Orlando or one of these other opportunities. He's probably not going to know that until July 3rd or 4th or whatever. You can't change horses then. That's not going to work.
And he also is making $11 million a year. And no matter where else he goes, it's hard to imagine him making that much or having the level of power that he has.
I don't know. The DeVosses have a lot of money, so they could maybe go in that direction.
All right, we're going to move on to Memphis momentarily, but first, this from our friends at CESO, SEESO.com, will get you 2 weeks free of awesome comedy. If you ever wanted to go to Miami with Jonah Ray, how about Honolulu, Washington, D.C.? You can visit all these great places and more in the second season of Hidden America with Jonah Ray, a travel show parody where the places are real, but the people are not. Stream every episode, including the brand new second season now on CISO. You also get unlimited access to Next Day Late Night, British cult comedy, stand-up specials, and binge-worthy classics like all 42 seasons of SNL, which is my personal favorite, and the entire Monty Python catalog. It's all on demand and ad-free. You can access it anytime, anywhere, almost any device, iPhone, Android, Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, Windows, Xbox One, for just $3.99 a month. And that's after, of course, you get the 2 weeks free using the promo code CAPSPACE at checkout, which lets them know that you came from us. That's CESO.com, SEESO.com, promo code CAPSPACE. So Memphis is not nearly as complex. They've made it through these last two off seasons, retaining their two franchise icons, Conley and Marc Gasol. And frankly, in terms of just those two guys, they're better off than we thought. I mean, those two guys both played better this year. Gasol coming off that broken foot, Conley, you know, getting up into his late 20s now, shot the ball better than ever. I think he averages most points per game. He was fantastic in the playoffs against San Antonio. It's just that the rest of the team is kind of let them down. And of course, Chandler Parsons, they have him cluttering their books this season to the tune of $23 million and then $24 and $25 million the next 2 years. So that leaves them now in a situation where they have these free agents, Zach Randolph, Jermichael Green, Tony Allen, Vince Carter as well, but you know, he's 41, so not as much of a priority. And they basically, this is not the type of team that I think is going to be a tax team, just given their small market, their ownership, and frankly, where they are in terms of contention. So they've essentially got $26 million to fit Randolph, Green, and Allen and stay below the tax. Do you think that they could do that?
They probably need at least one of those guys to take less than their full market value. But
yeah, Tony Allen did say, you know, I'm not trying to break the bank, but, you know, we'll see what his idea of breaking the bank and everyone else's is too. But he says he wants to stay. And Randolph, you know, I think like that is one thing they have going for them is they kind of have like a more family type of atmosphere there.
And those guys have reached greater heights in their career than I think we expected by virtue of being in Memphis. And there is a benefit to being an institution. And also, I don't think those two are going to see particularly robust markets just because of where they are in their whole careers. So maybe Memphis has not more leverage, but maybe they have a little bit better negotiating position than they would have before. So it will be weird that Jermichael Green will probably be the highest paid of the three, just considering his contributions to the team.
Green, a restricted free agent. He's 27. Randolph will be 35. And Allen also 35, just for the record there.
So Jermichael Green, part of it, his appeal is a matter of perspective. He shot 38% from three this year at a pretty good attempt rate, but
really, I thought his attempt rate was actually pretty low. Like I thought he was shooting like, you know, two a game or something like that.
Well, no, but in terms of the proportion of shots, it's 29% of his shooting attempts. He's just a low usage player. So, you know,
yeah, but I still think I would, if I'm really believing in him as like a stretch four guy, I think he can be a good player and he shot well in the playoffs, but I think he needs to be shooting four threes a game, five threes a game, not two.
Sure. And I think that's certainly fair to note. But I mean, and also we're drawing this on a guy who made 55 threes this year. Like that's his career high. He never made more than 15 in a season. So I would not be betting on that if I were a GM as being a big part of his profile. He is a talented guy in other ways, but it's basically what you're selling yourself on is, okay, if he can be a league average or below league average power forward, he's 27, you're not taking that much downside risk into this in terms of aging. Maybe you are in terms of representative performance. So, you know, maybe you could do that. We hope that he can switch a little bit more. Maybe he can fit in better with a little bit faster of a team. But the problem for Memphis is that there just aren't that many guys like him on the market.
Yeah, that's a combo forward type of guys like him who can shoot a little bit, who can switch, still has some athleticism, although he's not quite as, he was like close to a nuclear. I think that was actually an interesting question that we got on the Twitter NBA show that we should repeat at some point of like, who are the nuclear athletes in the league to really like think about that. But he's not quite there anymore at 27. He's older now, past his athletic peak. I think that, you know, between, considering he's also restricted, I mean, maybe he could just, some team would be like, hey, we're just going to pay him $16 million a year because we kind of run out of options and hey, why not? But I think more fair for him, I don't see him as like really quite, you know, a guy you're like that high on for a starter, at least offensively. So I'm thinking of him as more kind of, you know, high end backup, low end starter. Then you maybe a little bit of a depressed market because he's restricted. And so, you know, between $8 and $12 million a year for 3 years, maybe a fourth year, you know, that it's either going to be, I think like the amount of guaranteed money for him will probably end up between $30 and $40 million. That's kind of where I think it'll land.
I'm good with that. But I want to ask you a question. I feel like you know Jermichael's game better than I do. What do you think is a good fit for a center next to him, excluding, you know, elite guys who can do everything?
Like what type of player?
Yeah, like do you need a good rim protector next to him, obviously. So like, cause he's not.
I mean, I don't know why no power forwards really are good rim protectors anymore. There's four good power forwards who can.
Because basically what I'm thinking about is, does he have any sort of like a unique sales pitch, like something that he brings to the table for a team like Sacramento or something? Because a part of the free agency that I've gotten better at projecting over time, though I'm still not perfect, is the guys who just have something specific that makes the team fall in love with them, like their shooting, or, you know, maybe they can they have better ball handling than usual for their position, because it only takes one team to fall in love with a guy. I mean, I think Alan Crabb is a good example of this. Alan Crabb's actually a special ability with scarcity, but he got, you know, he got a ton of money. And in this case, the reason why I'd be a little scared if I was Memphis is if you liked him enough that you could put, that you could justify a high number, you could believe that they might not match because of the luxury tax.
Yeah, that's a good point, especially because you think they kind of have to bring back Randolph and Allen. And I think like the appeal of Green is just that he doesn't really have any major weaknesses that you can tell, if in fact he can shoot well enough that you have to guard him out there, which it seems like he has. I mean, we don't really know that for sure, but so I think and we've seen in the playoffs how important it is just having players who aren't like, all right, this guy can be an okay defender, he can switch, we're not going to take advantage of him, and he can hit a shot, so we can't just not guard him. Just having somebody like that, sometimes that's even more useful than, you know, Lou Williams, who, yeah, he can get really hot on offense, but then like you can just play him off the floor defensively and just go right at him. And, you know, he really struggled to defend it in that Spurs series. You know, sometimes someone like Green is just is more useful in a playoff setting. Now, you know, Memphis, we're talking about the first round here too, so I think his ability to switch is useful to kind of around maybe slower centers to just help prevent penetration to begin with. And so, you know, I think he's a useful player, but he's also not someone where it's like, all right, if he gets offered $15 million a year, I think Memphis just says, all right, you know what, it's like, our sun is kind of setting on this group anyway, let's just bring back Allen and Randolph, and, you know, as long as it's not for a couple more than two more years, hope that Parsons can get healthy, and then, you know, we won't need Green as much. We still got James Ennis, and, you know, we can get something out of Brandon Wright, go with some two big looks, or we can go with hope that Jarrell Martin can contribute. Now we've got Deontay Davis, a guy that we're high on. Another thing they could do too to try and clear off a little more space would be to just move Brandon Wright. I think that probably he would be movable. I think he would actually be a nice backup center target for a lot of these teams. He actually played fine this year. His stats are kind of the same as they always were, coming off of basically a year of not playing. And then, you know, he was out of the rotation by the playoffs just because he can't really fit next to Gasol or Randolph very well against a lot of teams. But I think he could make a great backup center for a lot of teams still.
I agree with you on that. And one of the unusual characteristics of Memphis this year is that outside of Chandler Parsons, they have a lot of movable salary, but none of it is expensive. So, you know, it's kind of like it's hard for them to clear space just because it's so concentrated in Chandler Parsons, who I don't think anybody really wants right now. He's not a permanently toxic asset, but he is a toxic asset for right now. But the good part about that is that they have a lot of money, or they have a lot of roster spots tied up in players that I think are actually intriguing or good. You know, like Ennis, you mentioned.
Yeah.
Between Baldwin and Harrison, I think you can get a decent player. They have a team option actually technically on Wayne Selden. He showed some flashes in the playoffs. You know.
Yeah. June 24th is when they have to decide on that. But yeah, I thought Wayne had some athleticism and his shot looked okay. I would be willing to keep him around some better options.
I think their front office has done a nice job identifying guys and not giving them bad contracts. Troy Daniels wasn't as impactful as I'd hoped this year, but he's making $3 million. Who cares? You know, that's totally fine. He's still a worthwhile gamble. And so that is a good place to be, but it does make it harder in the very, very near term in terms of like, if they can bring back these guys, but they're trying to squeeze them for an extra couple million, that gets harder to do.
Randolph, my prediction for him is around maybe 2 years, $20 million, maybe a partial non-guarantee on a third year, you know, just for like a couple of million, like kind of similar to the Al Jefferson contract from last year. He'll chafe at that because he's better than Jefferson. But again, you know, not as much money around. Maybe it's a hometown. And Randolph has made, you know, well over, you know, $150 million in his career. So, and then Tony Allen, maybe something like 2 years, $12 million, something along those lines might be reasonable for him. And then, you know, if you could get Green at 3 for 30 and Randolph 2 for 20, Allen 2 for 12, you can probably narrowly skirt the tax. Maybe they would need to make some moves during the season, you know, but let's say, you know, they're able to bring back most of these guys. What do you see them as needing here if they're going to try and add a little bit? I mean, they probably will be limited to the taxpayer mid-level rather than the full mid-level. The apron is $6 million above the tax, but you can't exceed that for any reason, so you're probably going to be limited to the mini mid-level unless you lose one of Green, Randolph, or Allen. Mini mid-level is $5 million, and the full mid-level is $8.4 million to start this year.
I think what you would want, and this actually ties in pretty well with the idea of just maybe not spending the whole amount there if they need to, is more options at a couple of different spots. So basically, another point guard would be nice. You know, maybe Andrew Harrison works out, maybe Wade Baldwin works out, but just another option there. If you trade Brandon Wright, another option at center in case Deontay, Jarrell, in case those guys aren't ready. And then on the wing, I think that it'd be the best spot there would be to have another two. I like James Ennis as a backup three. I'm a fan of his talent, and I thought he showed showed some nice burst. So you just kind of want a couple of guys, and that also ties in that they just don't have that many needs for roster spots. So they need to be just really good at processing that, or if they can get players to take their money that they like, they should be able to get out of one or two of those contracts and just basically choose one guy over another one. But you look at some of the players who are gobbling up roster spots, let's say for the Orlando Magic or even for the Clippers, you've got players like, I don't even know who would be on this team. Maybe let's say Wayne Selden. Like if they picked up Wayne Selden's option, I think there would be a team that would just happily take him on.
Maybe. I mean, keep in mind, he was available I guess he had a 10-day first with New Orleans, but and he started in the playoffs. I mean, maybe that gives him a little bit more gravitas. I mean, I think they definitely need a more veteran point guard option, but maybe more of like someone on the borderline between second and third point guard type of player. You know, so Jose Calderon, again, I mean, not that I think he's really that good, but, you know, he could reunite with Marc Gasol, just be like a veteran mentor, and games where like Harrison is just kind of blowing it, like Calderon can come in and be steady, hit some shots, but potentially out of their price range, but I don't think so. Like Ray Felton, Ty Lawson, you know, might be one that they could look at. They've had some success there with troubled souls over the years. And then I think they definitely need if it's not in the backup point guard, they need some kind of like a pure gunner type of guy, just someone who can score, create something on their second unit. I mean, because they had to go to Zach Randolph in the post every time, and that really just didn't work that well. So like Shabazz Muhammad, depending on what happens with his qualifying offer in Minnesota and whether Minnesota decides to use cap space and jettison him. Tyreke Evans, again, is a reclamation type of contract, you know, maybe like $5 million with a second year player option for Tyreke Evans might be a thought, or then even lower down the scale, an Aaron Brooks type of guy or a Rodney Sucky type of guy, just somebody who can do something off the dribble and just like create a few shots here and there. There are not that many of those guys on the market this year, but I think they desperately need one.
Marcus Thornton might be an option too, but I think he's past his prime there.
Yeah, no, he's more just like, I'm talking about someone who at least can like break the paint on occasion. Where are they at in terms of future draft picks and this year's draft pick?
Not great, Bob. I don't think this wasn't a part of the plan at all, but I do love that both of the teams that we're covering have protected pick obligations to the Boston Celtics. So the both actually involving Jeff Green, which is even better. I believe.
Yeah, yes, that is not.
Yes, it is. It is, because I think so, because one happened in two moves. So basically, the Clippers pick was when they acquired Jeff Green. Then they sent that pick. No, they can't be both involved in that. That doesn't make any sense.
No, I told you that it's Memphis has. Oh no, you know what it is? It is that because that pick that they got for Jeff Green from the Clippers then got sent for 31 and 35 in the 2013 draft. So they traded this year's pick. Yeah, so it is. You are right about that. And so they still have Rade Zagorac, who is number 35 in 2016. I think he's a Serbian swingman. He might be another Balkan country. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I don't know if he's going to be playing on coming over.
But we should clarify protection on the pick to the Celtics. So it's top 8 protected in 2019, then top 6 protected in 2020, and then unprotected in 2021.
Yeah, and they screwed that up. Like for Jeff Green in the last year of his deal, I mean, as it appeared at the time, everyone thought he was going to opt out. Like you should have been able to get lottery protection on that. Like Jeff Green is just not that good. I don't know what Danny Ainge did. I mean, that pick is one of the best picks out there, because this Memphis team is going to be in struggle city over like 2019, 2020, 2021. And then they do not have their own first rounder this year. That was initially in the Mo Spates trade, and that now belongs to Denver. It went to Cleveland and then was part of the Timofey Mozgov package going from Cleveland to Denver. So they are definitely draft pick poor. It's just a question kind of how long they can hang on. You know, I mean, 43 wins this year is not very good. I don't really see how they better that next year, unless they get major production from some of these young guys like Martin and Davis, and Harrison takes a step forward, and of course Parsons can like actually play a full season, which, you know, you really wonder whether that's ever going to be possible again. I mean, if I'm Memphis, I am planning like he's not going to play next year. And then if he does, well, you can never have too many wings.
Plus, Conley and Gasol, they played 74 and 69 games respectively. I think that's a fair benchmark moving forward. Gasol only missed 8 games, and Conley, he gets nicked up. You know, he's a Terminator, but he's going to miss a little bit of time, and that's fine. And so if that's where you were, and the team had, I think their net rating was pretty close to even. Yeah, I think they were plus 0.5, so they were basically a 500 team. They ended up 43 and 39. Yeah, so if they're a little bit worse than that, and then there's also the possibility of disaster potential, just if one of those guys gets really hurt. We've already seen it before.
One of the sections that we have on here is what's the effect on their future flexibility of any signings this year. Well, they can't sign that much, and they basically will not have any possibility of cap space because they've got Gasol, Parsons, and Conley together make at least $80 million over the next 3 seasons. So Gasol is a player option in that last year, but it is likely that they would not have cap space unless they move one of those 3 guys until the summer of 2020. It's a long time, and they are going to be in very, very great difficulty. I mean, what I foresee happening ultimately, and you know, maybe it's just like Conley and Gasol stay here forever, but I mean, if those 2 guys are staying here forever and they're making the money that they're slated to make, and Parsons as well, who might be untradeable, like if all those guys are still on the team in 2020, I mean, they're going to be winning 30 games. Like, max, probably, unless they can just pull some stars like out of their ass from like these late draft picks or free agent guys or whatever.
Also, Chandler Parsons in particular, like, let's say this goes really badly, there is not an amnesty provision in this CBA, and his contract is so big, and it kind of ties in with the late end of it. I don't think you'd even want to stretch him, because then you're throwing like $8 million a year on for a couple of years, and that's a lot of money. That's more than Terrence Williams.
Yeah, it's a lot more than a couple of years, and so I mean, maybe you would say if it were another team, but you know, Gasol and Conley kind of have like, everyone seems to have this love affair with Memphis, which is a credit to their organization and to the city that people don't want to leave. But you know, on most organizations, you would say, okay, you know, now we're winning 40 games every year. Conley and Gasol are still pretty good, but not like good enough at their salaries to like carry a team to 50 wins. So now you trade those guys to some other teams that are more contendery, and you maybe take back some bad salary and you start to rebuild. But if those guys don't want to be traded, then what are you going to do? Are you going to move them, or you know, that'll be an interesting drama here in Memphis that could, I think, manifest as early as, you know, next summer if they don't make the playoffs this year, which I think is a distinct possibility.
And the young Bucks in the West are only going to keep coming. You know, the teams like Minnesota, and even if you know, we never know if Sacramento is going to get their act together, but there are a lot of these
New Orleans will be better next year
at some point. Phoenix might figure it out. Like, not only the likely teams, but you start to get into some of the unlikely ones that they're rolling the dice enough times that they're going to start to get into these possibilities. And that's a real problem when you also consider that the similarly old teams are going to age probably better than Memphis will.
Yeah. All right. I think we're done here. Thanks so much for watching. Don't forget to check out Dunked On Video on my YouTube. I'm tweeting that out as well. Nate Duncan on YouTube. And that is basically just a recap, as we called it live on the Twitter NBA show, of the Spurs run that broke the game open. Their 19-3 run we're going to be doing for most of these games. That video recap help you get into the Twitter NBA show as well, which will be back for game 6 of Boston and Washington. And then we also will be doing a special edition of the show tomorrow night as well, because we took off Wednesday night, so we'll be doing Friday night instead. Stay tuned for that. Oklahoma City and Chicago offseason previews, both very interesting, in addition to that wrap-up of Game 6, Boston and Washington. And our sponsors today, don't forget about them as well. CISO, CISO.com, offer code CATSPACE, get your first 2 weeks free. And Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L and Branch, CATSPACE code gets you $50 off. Oh, and don't forget about our Patreon as well, patreon.com/DuncanLarue, if you enjoy our content and like to support it, in particular the Twitter NBA show. And I promise I won't spend as much time plugging this stuff as before. And also check out Danny's offseason previews on Sports Illustrated. So now we are done here, and we'll catch you next time.